This is another iRaw podcast.
So it's fair to say that we don't have any international tool to effectively counter the negative effects of globalization experienced by animals.
Welcome to episode 5 of The Animal Turn. In this episode, we're going to speak about extraterritorial jurisdiction with Charlotte Blattner. Charlotte is an exceptional researcher who I've had the pleasure to meet here at Queen's University when she was conducting her postdoctoral research. And she is currently a senior researcher and lecturer at the Institute for Public Law at the University of Bern. She earned her PhD in international law and animal law from the University of Basel. And in addition to her postdoctoral program here at Queen's University, she did another one at Harvard Law School in the Animal Law and Policy program. Charlotte has recently published 2 books pertaining to animals. The one, which we'll be speaking about a lot in today's episode, is Protecting Animals Within and Across Borders. And the second, which she co-edited with Will Kimlicker and Kendra Coulter, is called Animal Labor, A New Frontier of Interspecies Justice. Now, before we dive straight into the conversation with Charlotte, I thought I would try something new in episode 5. I'm going to try from here on out to do a bit of housekeeping at the beginning of each episode. This will help me in flagging potentially bothersome noise, which I know has been coming up in some of the previous episodes, and maybe to reflect a little bit on what I'm learning as we move on through these episodes. We're about halfway through season 1 now. I'm thinking 10 episodes per season would be a good mix. So far in season 1, we've touched on a number of important concepts and ideas, and we've unpacked them a little bit. Everything from looking at animal rights with Will Kimlicker to realizing that actually animals have very few rights in and of themselves, even to the idea of legal subjects, and that animals are not really subjects in the law because they are considered property. And as long as you are property, you cannot be a legal subject. And this has also touched on different episodes with looking at the idea of first possession, because if you are property, you are something that can be possessed, and whoever has ownership of you is kind of determined by who gets you first. And finally, in the last episode, we spoke to Manisha Decker, what would potentially open up the avenues for considering animals as subjects in the law, and personhood is maybe one way and legal beingness another. But today's episode with Charlotte, we start to look at something of a bigger concept. It's still a legal concept, but now we're starting to go a bit broader than just animals in and of themselves or even the state. But we're considering kind of the connections between states and animals between states as well. It is quite a complicated idea when you start to realize that animals are crossing borders all the time, and that there are a variety of laws and policies in place that manage their movement. But of course, again, they're being managed as property and as goods. And Charlotte has done an in-depth, detailed account of what she thinks is a potential way forward at a global scale in terms of thinking about animals and how we can improve animals' lives. So without further ado, let's get started. I was reading a bit about you this morning, and of course I've met you in Kingston where you did your postdoc. And I'm extremely happy to have you here today because I remember that lecture of yours here in Kingston. And I remember going up to you, I was just starting my PhD and I was like, you're doing everything. Everything you're saying is amazing. You've got a very distinct place in my memory, which is wonderful. But perhaps we can find out a little bit about you. How did you get interested in animal studies?
Oh, God, what a question. I don't know. It kind of starts with the question of how did you get interested in animals, right? Because one is kind of intimately tied to the other. Of course, it's conceptually a hugely interesting field from multiple perspectives and disciplines. But I think a lot of people are drawn to the field also for ethical reasons. And so the question of what brought you to animal studies is also often what brings you to animals or what brought you to animals. And so in my case, it was always like personal work with animals, be it rescue work or work in shelters, etc. And then kind of the dichotomy that emerged between that work and my professional work as a lawyer. And I can be very frank here. Like, I chose to study law simply because I thought that would give me most of the options in life. I can do many different things. I could do litigation, I could work in legislation, I could do consulting, etc. And then in all types of areas, right? So once I began to realize that the two can actually be combined, it was almost like a dream job that could emerge.
And who inspired that connection? Was there something you read where you thought, wow, there is a connection between law and animals?
Oh, God. Well, during my studies, I just, the maximum of expectations, and the expectations were very low, was that I could somehow just do pro bono work on the side. Once I passed the bar exam and I'd be a practicing lawyer, I could just simply, you know, get on some cases of animals being mistreated and then kind of have the experience of working with animals that way. But yeah, there was actually a trigger moment in my life. So there was a doctoral program that was created at my home university, the University of Basel, which was plain in animal law. And then lots of people approached me and they were like, you should apply for this. And when I thought about it, or when people approached me, I didn't even know what a PhD really was. Lots of people in Switzerland do it just for, yeah, maybe, I mean, in a sense, a bit out of vain, probably, maybe just to have a title and stuff. So I wasn't initially drawn to the idea of it. And once I began to realize how influential academia is in this area, because I mean, Will talked about this in the first episode of your series, right? If once you realize that animal law is mostly non-existent, you begin to actually realize that the role of academia in this area is huge and hugely important.
So do you still practice within the legal system, or are you primarily now within an academic realm?
It's a bit of both. So once I started with the doctorate, and it was like a hole that soaked me up, because I loved every bit and part of it. And only now gradually am I turning again to practice. And that, I mean, for the simple reason that because animal law is so limited in the way that it exists right now, the options for you to litigate are very limited too. So you could deal with, you know, cats and dogs and other companion animals. But the options for you to litigate cases when it comes to animals who are used for agricultural purposes are much more limited. So what I tend to focus on is, so maybe one case I could mention quickly is the primate case, which was often referenced internationally. So the Canton of Basel, which you mentioned before, you've also visited, an organization launched a citizens initiative for primate rights. So basic rights for primates, rights to life, liberty, and personal integrity that ought to be enshrined in the cantonal constitution. And maybe just on a side note for people who are not well-versed with the Swiss system. So Switzerland has 26 cantons. This is the equivalent of states in the US, for example. So we had this initiative that was launched, and we've actually managed to gather the necessary signatures for that in a pretty short period of time. But the initiative was stopped at the parliamentary level. The parliament, or the legal services to the parliament, claimed that the initiative would be invalid because it would encroach upon the federal competencies. So only the federal government would have the competence to actually decide on whether animals should get basic rights or not. And this is because the federal government enacted the Animal Welfare Act, right? So we've been dealing with a legal case for the last 2 years now, and it's pending at the Supreme Court in Switzerland right now as to whether we can go ahead and let the people of Basel decide on whether primates should have basic rights or not. And if we succeed, and most people say we have pretty good chances, but I mean, touch wood. crazy times right now, and I don't know how it will play out. But if we succeed with it, it will be the absolute first time in history that people get to vote, human people get to vote on whether animals should have basic rights, or at least some of the animals.
That's incredible. So there's, I mean, there's a lot going on there, and a lot of questions to ask about. So, you know, one of the first ones that comes to mind for me is, it's come up in the previous episodes, is in, actually in the previous one I did with Manisha, it even came up, is this strategy of getting rights for one distinct group of animals like primates, is that revolutionary enough in that would it not be, you know, the whole idea of concentric circles. So now primates are included, then it's the next step of including another set of animals. At what point does that just take too long until we reach chickens and cows and maybe other agricultural animals? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is a very valid point, and one I'm, you know, hugely scared about. I think we do not, I mean, the concern is valid, but we do not yet have hard evidence as to whether that's true or not. So I believe when it comes to the reformism versus welfareism debate, we need to distinguish two cases. For example, if I as an NGO had the choice to advocate for bigger cages of one species of animals, be it, I don't know, birds, I wouldn't do that because it would still mean that they would be encaged, right? Mm-hmm. And you could still see that as a welfareist, reformist take on it. Whereas when I advocate for the rights of certain animals, I'm not thereby, at least not obviously also undermining the rights of other animals or the possibilities for that to happen. I believe that change, of course, can come quickly, and ideally we would have a legal reform that would establish rights for all animals, no question at all. But also here we need to draw the line at some point. Or bees, the animals that we will protect or not? I would say yes, but certainly most people wouldn't be ready to go that far. So we need more evidence on the idea about whether, you know, we need more evidence on whether that's actually true, and we need to get people acquainted to the idea of animals having rights. And that's not something that's happened so far. And so I believe once this happens, there is more opportunity to actually do empirical research on what the effects of that is. And that's at least worth a try, in my opinion.
That's really interesting. And I mean, you drew up a comparison between bees and primates there, which is, I think a lot of people appreciate, you know, how important bees are as pollinators, and then would possibly look at considering the idea of rights for primates because, well, to some extent, because of human exceptionalism, primates seem closer to us. They're more impersonal. They're a charismatic species often within primates. But you said we're in crazy times right now. COVID-19 is happening and there's a rapid race for a vaccine. And in the back of my mind, I know that who are in the labs are not bees, but primates. So are you concerned that the current state of affairs would, you know, because people always consider them as test subjects, as subjects that have to be tested on for vaccines or for other medicinal purposes. So even though we privilege them as primates, as being beautiful and majestic, and would maybe appreciate the idea of them as having rights, many humans might not think through or be resistant to the fact that they wouldn't be able to test their medicine on them, for example.
Well, that's a valid concern. Maybe I can look at it in two ways. Well, the first aspect that comes to my mind, as you mentioned, COVID-19 in the context of animals used for experimentation, really is that a lot of animals are now euthanized because laboratories are shut down. And so that just undermines how important rights would be in that context. So usually when you have a state of emergency in a state, you still need to be able as a state to guarantee constitutional rights. So say primates had constitutional rights, you wouldn't be able to just euthanize them or forget about them in the laboratories while a state of emergency is being proclaimed. That mm-hmm. I think is an important point to remember and would be like would really change the reality of lots of primates right now. And I can see it on social media in the past, especially 2-3 days, there's increased attention by scholars on this point. And then the second one is whether we'd be able to experiment on them. I mean, that always depends on the underlying legal regime and also on how you define rights, right? Mm-hmm. So rights means something for some people and another thing for many other people. And so when you think about certain forms of experimentation, be it for certain types of purposes or because they're, or when you look at the severity, there are already certain prohibitions in place, especially EU law has gone a far way in that respect. So some of the most severe experiments are not permitted on primates, and there's also purposes for which primates simply cannot be used for experimental in an experimental environment. But mm-hmm. this doesn't usually mean that they have rights, because prohibitions are very specific. They prohibit certain acts, but it doesn't guarantee them a right, which is often a more open-ended protection and applies in myriad different circumstances and social conditions. So there's definitely a distinction that needs to be drawn between prohibitions and rights.
Fair point. And it's great to hear some of the changes that are being made for primates. Perhaps we can move now a bit with, you know, COVID-19 is a global pandemic. It's cutting across the world. And one of our focuses today is on your idea of extraterritorial jurisdiction. I hope I said it correctly.
It's a horrible word.
it does not roll off the tongue.
No.
But so far in all the episodes, we've focused a fair bit on, you know, on states and state law and what a state could do. But you are expanding this idea. You're stretching beyond state boundaries in your thought. Is that correct?
In a sense, yeah. But in a sense, I'm also hugely expanding the idea of what still states' responsibilities and roles are in, you know, animal exploitation being a global phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So what is this idea then? What is extraterritorial jurisdiction?
Well, maybe I'll start with how I actually came to think about this. So prior to starting my doctorate, I attended quite conferences in the area of animal studies, be it animal law, animal ethics, etc. And I watched parliamentary debates on, you know, new propositions that were being made, be it, for example, that certain experiments on primates be prohibited or that better protections be put in place for pigs, or that, for example, as in Germany, male chicks should not be shredded anymore for egg and poultry production. And so whenever I observed these debates, I could see that there is one argument that brought all of the arguments to a halt. And that was, well, that would be nice to have, or indeed, that would be what the constitutional law of our state would mandate. But we can simply not do that because production would move abroad. So mm-hmm. I can look left and right, and it's especially true of commercially used animals, less of, you know, animals that we keep as so-called pets or wild animals, but it's especially true of commercially used animals. So in regulatory theory, we call this the threat of outsourcing. And that's an extremely potent threat. It has to do with, you know, territorial supremacy of states, with power of corporations versus the state, with the power of capital. And it's also of a democratic concern, but we can go into detail with all of this in our interview today.
So that's... So in a nutshell, what you're saying there is that people or states didn't create these policies or laws because they thought, well, it's pointless for us to do it because that'll just be outsourced and done elsewhere. Is that correct?
Yes.
So in layman's terms.
Yeah. Sorry. Maybe to expand on this. So when we look at the numbers, we see a huge explosion in production and consumption of eggs, meat, and dairy. So while the world population has doubled since the 1980s, the consumption of meat, dairy, and eggs has increased threefold, sometimes fourfold. And we now have a hugely global web of cage systems, feed, breeding, veterinary practices, technology, slaughter, packaging, distributions, etc. Mm-hmm. And so what happens in these systems is that it's mainly corporations who actually own those animals. And they often move the production abroad as they're threatened by stricter laws. So they say, we're not going to stay here, we'll move elsewhere because production is simply cheaper, because slaughter is cheaper, because we don't want to be burdened by regulatory requirements, etc. And these entwined economic activities that have happened actually have nudged states to compete with each other in order to attract and retain manufacturers and investors. And the way that, I mean, that's called regulatory competition, but the really sad part about it is that states compete with each other not by actually increasing their levels of animal protection, but they do so by decreasing that level. So they're like, we don't want you, Corporation X, to move away because you're a, you know, really valuable taxpayer. So we'd rather keep you. And sometimes, like pharmaceutical corporations, agricultural industries, etc., are so powerful within small communities, but even, you know, states, that they can really force states to actually not adopt certain laws, to not enforce certain laws, or simply even brush over the democratic will of people to make sure that they'll stay. And in regulatory theory, we actually call this a race to the bottom. So one state lowers and then the other state lowers because they're in competition with one another for capital. And so the state with the lowest standards will actually end up winning this race. And when we look at it in global perspective, what happens is that we have an anchor toward the lowest common denominator. And in this context, it's really difficult to put in place laws for commercially used animals.
So the animals would lose and they continue to lose. So even if you've got welfarist or welfare or ideas of animal welfare protection in place, as long as companies are competing with one another to stay in particular places, to earn capital or to have a stake in market shares, then the care of animals is always going to play second fiddle, is always going to come
up. That's true. But I mean, the losers are not just the animals. The losers are also the people in that game. Because, I mean, think back of like the demand that male chick shredding be banned in Germany was hugely supported by the people. And the parliament just said, we won't do it because production would be moved abroad. And there's been case after case over several years right now. It went to the Constitutional Court, and this court said exactly the same. So economic arguments dominate this area. And what's really sad about this is that it has serious consequences for states within their territory. It's not just about protecting animals across the border, right? It is a race where what happens as an effect is that it undermines states' efforts to enact or uphold laws that protect animals. So whatever you propose, however valid your argument is, you'll always lose because of this economic threat. So maybe if I, all of this might sound a bit abstract, but maybe if I can just give one prominent example.
Sure.
So in the US in 2006, the federal government started to prohibit governmental funding for federal inspectors of horse meat. without those inspections, the institutions that actually slaughter horses would not be able to legally run their business anymore. So the funding ban effectively rendered horse slaughter illegal. And then in reaction to that ban from 2006 to 2007, the horse exports to Mexico increased by 312%. So In a sense, the entire horse slaughter industry from the US was effectively outsourced to Mexico. And because of this, more and more people in the US asked for the ban to be reversed, even if that meant that those horses wouldn't be protected from slaughter anymore. And that was even advocated for by those who wanted the horses to be protected. So their main claim was that US laws intended to protect animals have not helped, but actually failed them precisely because of globalization. Mm-hmm. So it's an environment in which states find it unnecessary or even counterproductive to enact stricter laws for commercially used animals if the borders remain open. And so to reiterate, what happens in global perspective is that really the lowest level of animal law anywhere in the world ends up defining and anchoring all global efforts to protect animals.
Would this also be considered what somewhat happens with cows in India, where there is a state law in some of the states of India where you cannot kill cows, but yet they are constantly, you know, exported across borders for both leather, beef, and dairy production. So yes. is that another example?
Oh, definitely. Very, very good example. And I use it in the book too. It's a huge problem because all of the cows are being moved to Bangladesh. And you have the army who is tasked to protect those cows, but they can only do so until the border, right? And there's ways in which you can counteract that, you know, threat of outsourcing, that watering down of animal protection laws. And that's basically what the book is about. And I use the umbrella of extraterritorial jurisdiction to actually bring all of these ideas together.
So perhaps you could walk us through it then. So how does, because I know in your explanation of the book in the beginning, you speak a lot about these global, what you call global entanglements, which I think shows how messy the globalization / capital use of animals is. Not just, you know, animals as whole beings, but even parts of them get sent to different parts of the world and are used in a variety of ways. But then you bring up this concept, and it's in the title of your book, which was released last year, right, in 2019?
Yes, exactly.
So just to give listeners the title, you said it's Protecting Animals Within and Across Borders, Extraterritorial Jurisdiction, and the Challenges of Globalization, which is really fascinating because most people, I think, speak about globalization as a positive. Globalization is a net good. We've got communication channels that are smaller, shorter. We're able to travel, you know, more frequently. That it's somehow it's an equalizer, that those that were once excluded in markets are included. But that's not the full picture. Globalization hasn't enabled everybody equally. So how do you view extraterritorial jurisdiction as a concept or as a, because it's already a legal concept, right? It's already something that is used in practice. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, maybe just to explain, and I haven't defined the term thus far. So maybe just to give it like a normal definition, extraterritorial jurisdiction just simply means states using laws across the border. We can read it at such, and we can go into detail later as to what different forms of extraterritorial jurisdiction there are, and you know, the legality is different for each of those tools. But yes, I mean, as you mentioned, and I don't think we need to go into that today, but definitely there are big losers of globalization. And there's an ongoing dispute in international law as to whether globalization has, even for people, been net good or bad. But definitely when it comes to animals, I think it's fair to say that globalization has been net negative, and extremely so. I mean, just looking at the numbers of animals, you know, used, exploited and killed for factory farm purposes is just astounding. And It's one argument to say, and I think it's a valid one, to say that we don't need the animals for our consumption because it's gustatory pleasures mostly. And it's quite another if you see that many of these animals are killed for no reason at all. So there's lots of practices of dumping milk and dumping flesh just to keep up prices for these animals. So yeah, commodification is a huge issue. But when we look at it in global terms, so one instrument to actually counteract the negative effects of globalization on people were or have been, they preceded globalization, human rights, right? So international rights that protect the most fundamental interests of humans. And we don't have any such equivalent for animals. And that makes any work to protect animals more capaciously in global perspective hugely difficult. And in addition to that, we don't have any international treaty actually protecting animals. So, for example, when we the treaties that are usually mentioned in that context are like the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling, CITES is another convention, or the Convention on the Conservation of Migratory Species, Convention on Biological Diversity, etc. But if you look at it from a more critical perspective, of course, these treaties are mostly focused on conserving or preserving a certain species. We don't have any such equivalent for humans. Like, imagine we had a treaty that just protected us as a species. That would be essentially no protection at all, because we're 8 billion and counting people, right? There's no fear at all that our species would ever die out, except from a few people. But, you know, it's essentially no protection for most of the animals. And in that scheme, most of the animals are not seen or perceived as having inherent individual worth. Individual beings are fungible. So if I'm an endangered lion, for example, and I give birth to two cubs, I can be killed because there's two more right now. It's the species that matters as a whole, not me as an individual. And my well-being and my interests do not usually matter under these schemes. And in addition to that, the numerically most exploited animals, which are farmed and research animals, are not even covered by these conventions. So it's fair to say that we don't have any international tool to effectively counter the negative effects of globalization experienced by animals.
So far, you know, in the episodes that have come up, people have spoken about the property status of animals, and that the fact that animals are seen as property is a baseline reason for why they have no rights, or why actually these protections are nil, because really it's about protecting humans' use of animals. So as long as animals remain under property status, the idea of them as subjects is challenged. And we've spoken a little bit also about the idea of personhood, and that maybe if they are considered as persons, they could have access to some of these rights or these protections, or not even have maybe start to have access to them. How would the idea of cutting across territory, so international law, is it that, let's say Switzerland decides to give personhood to the primates that you were speaking about earlier. Would the idea of extraterritorial jurisdiction now mean that because Switzerland has given it, that it follows primates that are in Switzerland? You're speaking more that you need a global international institution that is creating these concepts or these changes.
Oh, yeah. So a lot of points come together in what you've just said. And I just want to disentangle those for a minute. So the concept of extraterritorial jurisdiction, so the question of whether and when a state can apply law across the border, is essentially dealt with as a procedural question in law. The question of whether someone is a person, and, you know, the question of status, relationships, and rights of entities under the law is often a question of substantive law. So the mere fact that the Canton of Basel would give primates rights, for example, would not mean that it would be possible to apply those rights extraterritorially. My book looks at it from an international perspective. So this is because most states always say, we can't, you know, we can't apply law across the border, or we can't put in place trade restrictions because it would violate international law, notably trade law. And my book says, no, that's not true. It's totally legal under these and these conditions per international law. So what would need to happen in that case would be for either Basel or Switzerland as a state to, in the introductory part of the Animal Welfare or Rights Act or Constitution, define under which conditions the law can be applied across the border. That's just usually, I mean, this is just a procedural step, but that's usually what's also needed in addition to that. And then maybe the second point I want to mention is that I'm a bit hesitant to say that I am calling for an international institution or a treaty in that respect. I have a quite pessimistic view about that. So in light of all the challenges and problems that I just mentioned, most people actually think that the ideal situation would be to create an international treaty. So a treaty that would express a uniform commitment of states to recognize animals as sentient beings who matter, to maybe prohibit cruelty against animals, to prevent their suffering, to demand humane treatment, or maybe even to lay down robust rights for animals, right? So, as I looked at the conditions under which such treaties are formed, I found that, first of all, this is very unlikely. And we can look at antitrust law to actually see that. So it's unlikely because when we look at global consumption and production patterns, when it comes to animal corpses, it is that consumers and producers are unevenly distributed around the globe. So because they're unevenly distributed, states will respond differently. So when you have mostly consumers of animal products, which are mostly Western states, they will tend to overregulate because they want to protect the animals. But those states that are the main producers of animal corpses, they will tend to underregulate because they don't want their producers to be burdened by any regulatory requirements. So because they have such disparate interests, it's very, very unlikely for states to find a consensus. And I also believe that it might, even if we succeed to do that, it might be unhelpful because such agreements actually tend to converge to the lowest common denominator. So I don't know if I should talk about this, but we have plenty of examples of people who have proposed international conventions. So who actually reflect that. So there's an international convention for the protection of animals. There's the Universal Declaration of Animal Welfare. Two prominent examples, just to mention, they're not enforced. These are proposed conventions or declarations. And if you look at them at first sight, they might seem to be quite progressive. So, for example, the International Convention for the Protection of Animals says in Article 1, the fundamental principles, that humans and animals should coexist within an interdependent ecosystem. They also say that life has intrinsic value, that no animal should be killed unnecessarily or subjected to cruel acts or unnecessary suffering, etc. But, you know, as Will Kimlicka has, so beautifully articulated in the first of your series, what's necessary or not is usually not, this is not a tool to actually protect animals. So it's an extremely watered down version, and each state for itself will be able to define what's necessary or not. And then we also have articles in there that say the parties shall take appropriate steps to prevent cruelty and reduce suffering. Well, what's appropriate or not? That's
exactly
that is mostly, it's defined by humans for human purposes. And so animals are, or even, you know, a representation of their interests, it's just nowhere to be found in such conventions.
So what is it that you would propose then, or what is it that you are proposing throughout your book? So, because you had mentioned earlier on about human rights, for example, and those are, they kind of follow with me. I have them wherever I go, hopefully. But obviously that's shaped through practice, and they are ideals in many regards. Perhaps now we can maybe get into a bit of your actual concepts and what it is that you are proposing the way forward would be.
Yes. So there are two tasks that actually lay at the heart of the book. And one is to ensure that we can gain legal certainties about the ways in which states can protect animals better and more effectively within their territory. And that the second one is to find out in which instances it is appropriate and necessary to actually protect animals across the border. So in a sense, the main argument is that the entire factual entanglement that globalization has created calls for a response that is, you could see this as a form of legal entanglement. And so that's extraterritorial jurisdiction. Instead of trying to wait for an international regime to appear and to actually protect animals' interests, which I consider to be far, far ahead in the future, we should act right now and make sure that we can build like a jurisdictional net across the globe that helps and empowers us to better protect animals. That's basically the task of the book. And so I actually look at different areas in which that can be done. So I look at trade law, for example. I look at the GATT treaty that most of the people know, but there are other treaties under the WTO that are relevant. Then I look at investment principles, export credits. I look at financial institutions, World Bank, for example. I look at OECD principles. But I think what really is like the core of my work in that respect is that I look at the so-called jurisdictional principles of international law. And this is very abstract. Yeah. Can I make an example to kind of.
Yeah.
So
that would be great.
As you know, I used to work at Queen's University too. And since I'm a Swiss national and I work and live in Canada, for example, it's not just that Canadian law will apply to me. And, it's not just Canada that will have a say when it comes to the actions that I make. And so because I'm a Swiss national, also Switzerland has certain areas in which it can tell me what I should do or not. And that's usually actions of mine that are really relevant. So it would be killing someone else. It would be torturing someone else. It would be pedophilic acts, etc. And so in these instances, Switzerland says that it has a sufficient strong interest to actually make sure that the laws of Switzerland apply to my actions, regardless of whether Canada deems legal what I do or not. And this is just one principle. It's called the active personality or nationality principles. But there's a bunch of different principles that are used in that respect to actually make sure that there's effective protection globally. And so you can use the same, right? You can say, Charlotte, Swiss national in Canada, you, whenever you deal with animals, have to ensure XYZ. That would also be an application of this active personality principle as a form of direct jurisdiction. And there's many ways in which that can be done. So if I have a continuous act that I do across the border, say I ship animals from Canada to the US, then Canada, per international law, has the authority to actually regulate the whole journey of the animals traveling.
Okay.
Are you with me on that?
I'm with you. So I mean, you had mentioned at one point transboundary governance. So this would be regulating in many ways human behavior as well. And I'm guessing you unpacked a lot of different dimensions in your book. It's so comprehensive. I can't believe this is what came out of your PhD.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's not necessarily a positive thing. It's so comprehensive. So,
oh, it's, yeah. it's a hashtag PhD goals. I looked at that. I was like, wow. It's really an incredible book and piece of work. But the idea then is that it would follow, so it could regulate human behavior and human action. So you as a Swiss national would be subject to some laws from Switzerland. And for example, myself as a South African citizen living in Canada, I'm still subject to, you know, tax laws in South Africa or whatever it is. There are a variety of legal things, to use the legal term, legal items that stretch beyond borders, that restrict my behavior or enable my behavior in a variety of ways. And you are trying to look at this net or this entanglement as it pertains to animals.
Exactly. So whenever there's a factual entanglement, there is a potential legal anchor point, we call this. So there's a potential way in which you can tie states' jurisdictions to those acts. And I mean, I've used a very simple example of me as a natural person going somewhere else. But what I'm really trying to get at with the book is actually corporate behavior, not just human behavior. I mean, of course, corporate behavior is to some extent also human behavior. But if you think about the fact that most of the animals, commercially used animals, are owned by corporations, many of which are multinational corporations, you really want to get at what is the nationality of the corporation? And can I, per this nationality, regulate that corporation and tell that corporation what to do? So I look a lot, I had to look into corporate law to find out, can I get at this substitute? Can I get at this branch? Can I get at this daughter corporation or the parent corporation, etc.? So yeah, in a sense, I do regulate or look at a lot at how can we tackle and get at the ways in which we do wrong to animals. But
and what did you find when you said you went into corporate law to see is there a way? What did you find?
I mean, it's and I don't know how that slipped my mind, but I really need to mention this. This is hugely untapped potential. Extraterritorial jurisdiction is widely practiced and accepted internationally when it comes to competition law, banking law, criminal law, human rights law, etc. It's widely used and practiced. And in animal law, just no one has looked at this so far. And no state has had the thought that we should or could do that too. And so what I found was really that the options are incredibly vast and that this could really be a forceful tool to counter race to the bottom globally. But
that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really amazing. So I hope that the book will not just be, you know, of academic value, but actually make it to the table of policymakers, for example.
So what are your next steps with that in mind? Is there a way forward with the book where you're introducing it to maybe Swiss, you know, governance structures? Or what are the next steps with the type of work you're doing?
Oh, I wish that would be the case. So it wouldn't be just Switzerland, right? Because the work is in international law and animal law. You could basically use this book anywhere in the world and actually, you know, really counteract the harmful tendencies on a domestic level that there's no, I mean, states like to do that in parliamentary debates too, or when they speak to their people, they're like, our hands are tied. We can't do anything. It's international law. We would violate, you know, principles of international law. We would violate international trade law. And, you know, the book just says it's simply not true. It's used as an excuse, clearly, but this is not, it doesn't live up to the truth. That it's just not.
So it's a powerful tool for both those who are practicing within the legal realm, but also for advocates that are advocating and come up against this as a barrier. This is a tool that they could use to try and work through some of those debates.
Hopefully, yeah. And I also hope that it, you know, advances stalled debates when it comes to international animal law, where everyone comes up with this miraculous idea of setting up an international treaty for animals. and actually, you know, have a bit more critical perspective on that. And of course, I mean, as you say, the book is really long, and for a good reason, because it's a really complex topic. Also because, and we haven't spoken about this, maybe one aspect that we'll mention first and then the second one. So the first one is really that, and it ties into what Will said, you know, a lot of the law in animal law is used not just to manifest the use of animals and make sure that we have continuous access to their bodies, but animal law is also often used as a tool to tell other people how they should treat animals. And it's often a way to just impose certain ideals onto other people. And it's not about animals being protected in essence. It's about ensuring the imperialism of one nation over another, of one culture over the other, etc. And so that's really a huge concern of mine when it comes to extraterritorial jurisdiction, that states are not just blindfolded and believe, and by the way, every state believes that they have the best animal protection regime in the world, and then simply export that. Yeah, it would be horrible, right? So I don't know if you had a chance, but there are different ranking systems that rank states' animal laws. So what is the status of their laws? Do they have norms that recognize animals as sentient beings? Are there laws on the constitutional level? So the World Animal Protection Index is one example of that. And then the organization in Australia called Voiceless has another one of those. And in a way, it's good because you can cross compare a lot. But if you look at it from a broader meta perspective, you're like, all of this isn't really that different, especially if you look at the numbers of animals killed. If you actually look at what the conditions are for these animals as they live their lives, it's not that different. And so what I advocate for in the book is that, you know, extraterritorial jurisdiction really is a chance for states to more critically look at their levels of animal law and have a really honest conversations about where they want to get to. So ideally, we would have a ranking system that included animals as persons, animals as members, animals as rights holders, etc., and then actually rank the state in that ranking system. And we would see that all of the states are just at the bottom, not even in the 0.1% that they should be, and that they should do much more to actually get there. So ideally, extraterritorial jurisdiction would create a kind of a race to the top, where states would compete with each other to actually put in place stronger protections, rights for animals, stronger legal tools, actually do a better job.
But now throughout this interview, you've spoken quite a bit about how animals are entangled within capitalist networks, how, you know, there is a drive to push down their protections because the less protection or care there is for animals, often the cheaper it is to produce whatever it is that's being produced, whether it's dairy, whether it's meat, whether it's leather. There's a drive for profit and for bigger means of profit. So in this idea of the race to the top, in a world that is defined by economics and defined by capital growth, what interest is it for them to do this for the race to the top? Why not just maintain the status quo?
Good question. I mean, this is a really good question and one I would love to know the answer to. I'm being honest. I mean, there's only so much each of us can do in our work, and I would love to know the answer to that. But I think one of the really strong arguments about, you know, the way in which I try to disentangle what the problem is with the current status quo is really that it's also problematic from a democratic point of view. You have, I mean, polls, and you can say a lot about polls, they're rigged polls or they're polls with, you know, a small number of people being made, etc. But if you look at it from a broader perspective, most of the polls that are being done on animal rights, welfare, any of the animal issues really show that most people want animals to be better protected. And if you look at the practice within parliaments or regulatory agencies that actually apply the law, it's exactly the opposite practice that is happening. And that's really, really problematic. I think there would need to be much more done in terms of, and I have like a hierarchy of presumptions that I set up. We would need to have a huge turn when it comes to transparency. Most people have absolutely no idea about how animals are treated. They have cognitive dissonance as to, you know, the steak on my plate, of course, hasn't been treated, you know, it doesn't come from a cow. And if it were to come from a cow, the cow would have been treated nicely, etc. We would have to have, you know, recognition of animal interests. We have to make sure that animals' interests are integrated in decision-making processes. We would have to have much more extensive and detailed laws. Also, and this is something I'm worried about all the time, we would have to have an adequate conceptual framework as to how we balance interests between humans and animals, because most of the time the two conflict and we have a rigged balance of interest scheme that just, you know, is there for human interests. Then we would have to have prohibitions and, of course, animal rights. But this is a long way to go there. And I agree that, you know, economic realities like capitalism really, you know, make it difficult for us to keep up the hope. Yeah.
Well, it's huge. But I do think that you are entering what's a really exciting realm in that, you know, even amongst humans, we have conflicting interests, and our interests are not always equal to one another, and we are always meeting one another in differential power hierarchies, right? Depending on the context that we find ourselves in. But I think until animals are taken seriously by us, and that becomes the social norm. So I think it's a question of which comes first, the law, and we spoke about this as well with Will, you know, the law or the social practice. And I think until you start to see the animal on your plate as a being, or until, you know, animals are viewed as more than products, even if not legally, but just as every day in our day-to-day lives, we start to take seriously what their lives mean. You know, I think that's a way in which the status quo can begin to be challenged, that maybe there's a fertile space for us to start to consider some of this transboundary governance that you're speaking of. And I think, I mean, what you're proposing is quite revolutionary, because in a nutshell, it's about actually disrupting the supremacy of economics in how we structure our lives.
True, definitely true. And I think we've neglected, you know, we've had so many valuable arguments and articles in animal ethics and politics, etc., are so valid, valuable, and revolutionary. Yet when you look at the law side, people are like, oh, this is utopian. We can't do this. Like, we're not even considering it. And this dichotomy has really drawn me. It has pulled me down for many years. So, I mean, in a nutshell, it's really frustrating to work in animal law, in a sense, because you feel so alienated from the discipline itself that is so complicit, even constitutive in, you know, producing all the suffering of animals. So that's what led me to actually also think about economics. But I wanted to mention something else about what you've said before about whether either the practice or legal reform, whether one precedes the other. And I think we always tend to speak as if, you know, most of us live in Western countries, and we always tend to speak as if the Western reality would be the only reality in the world. And so what I really want to do with the book and my work in, you know, in broader perspective, is to actually make sure that people stop universalizing everything and start to appreciate that legal change often comes from within a community, and a very powerful one. So just to bring an example in that context, I don't know if you've heard that, but Switzerland has, and it's been one of the first states to actually have constitutional protection of animals. And the norm is very unique in that it protects the so-called dignity of animals. And now you can say a lot about, you know, how this, of course, can be a misnomer because animals are still slaughtered in Switzerland. But it has had a real effect when it comes to case law. So it has led to prohibitions on experimenting on macaques, for example, or certain macaques, especially when the balancing test did not succeed. But what I want to say about that is people have voted on this provision to be part of the Constitution. And prior to this legal change, they had no concept or there was no social practice of animal dignity. But right now, if you ask the people in Switzerland, they know that animals' dignity is protected. And they say that's really hugely important. So this is a kind of a reverse case because the dignity provision was introduced in the context of biotechnology, GMO testing. So that's how it emerged in 1992 as a kind of tool to ensure that no GMO would be done when it comes, but also when it comes to animals, for example. So right now, this has morphed into we as a nation protect the dignity of animals, which in this case, the legal reform has totally changed social views about animals in Switzerland.
And they start to shape one another as well, because I imagine that Swiss people are now taking pride in the fact that you are the first country to consider animal dignity, and it starts to become part of your identity as Swiss people, maybe, hopefully. And the more, when I was speaking about practices, maybe, is I think the more that becomes a norm and part of human identity, that part of who we are is to respect the dignity of animals, then maybe those legal reforms become more robust and more important. And as they become more robust and more important, it starts to shape more and more of Swiss identity, hopefully.
That's where your work is really, that's why your work is hugely important in that respect, right? So you look at the presence of so-called animals used for farming purposes in urban areas. And I think that is hugely important because these positive encounters with animals are really often what changes our practices with them. So in the beginning of this podcast, you've asked me, what brought me to animal studies? And I told you that the question should be what brought me to animals. And the way in which I started to really think beyond this kind of narrow social membership enclave in which I lived, if, you know, Will Kimlicka were to term it that way, was actually by having an encounter with a so-called farmed animal. So I used to have a dog, and with him I'd go for walks in the woods 2-3 hours a day. And in Switzerland, CAFOs are, of course, a reality, but lots of animals are on the meadows. So you could go and say hi to them as you please. And so there was the herd of cow that was always hugely interested in him. And so the more we, spent time with them, the more they would be okay with our presence. And so one day we entered the meadow and actually lay in the grass with them for half an hour or so. And it just struck me at that moment, how can I would never even think about eating my dog. And the other animal who I suddenly realized was an individual. Some of the herd members were sassy, some were reluctant, some were really shy, others were really, I don't know. So there were all kinds of characters in the herd, and I started to realize that I could just never say yes or being okay just with the idea of one of those, you know, members of the herd being killed. And so this encounter has really changed my life for good.
Yeah,
hopefully,
amazing story.
So hopefully that would be, a source of inspiration for many other people.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I think there is a reckoning and something about meeting animals as beings with personality and with life. That's really profound. We have been chatting for almost an hour now, actually just over an hour. So before we wrap up, it's incredible. And I think you've gone full circle by, you know, what you said, how you came to animals and then drawing us back to that right at the end here. It's really quite beautiful. But before we wrap up, do you have a paragraph or a quote you would like to read, perhaps from your own book or from someone who's inspired you?
Yes, I'd love that. So it's a quote that's in my book, but not from me, that I would love to read. And I believe it's a really beautiful quote because it ties my work to some of the issues that, you know, you've been discussing in the context of the blog of the podcast. So I'm really concerned about the fact that we shouldn't just consider animal interests, but that there should be a way in which they can be co-participants and co-deciders of what the future should look like. And so there's a really cool short introduction to law by Kristen Stilt in the book, in the edited collection, Critical Terms for Animal Studies. And I'm just going to quickly just reiterate what she says in that context. When it comes to making law from humans and applying them onto animals and the problems that we create thereby, and maybe also opportunities for alternative visions. So she writes, "Animals did not ask us as humans to make laws that apply to them, nor did we ask them if they wanted our laws. Under an alternative framework, we might relate to animals as differing self-governing societies related to one another. Instead, we impose our jurisdiction and our laws on animals. We use law to put animals into categories of our own choosing and control them, both conceptually and physically. We use law not to recognize, embrace, cultivate, and enable our innate characteristics and abilities, but rather to position them in a way that is convenient and conducive to our own wants and needs. Animals do not have the ability to challenge us on our own terms because they're not formally part of any society's lawmaking process."
That's incredible. And so to the point, I love the idea of, she doesn't use the words, but of animal governance, that animal societies do exist. They do govern themselves on their own, quote in quotations, laws and their own rules, and we don't recognize those necessarily.
Yeah. So that would be a beautiful, like, alternative visions of what law is and could be. Interspecies
Incredible.
Law, if you will.
Yeah. Like, it's an interesting thing to think through because we've got a lot of, you know, animal ethology, you know, we've got a lot of research that's been done on understanding animal societies and understanding how animals structure their lives and their communities. But we tend to frame that almost exclusively through the idea of instinct. You know, we don't frame what we do as humans as instinctual. Sometimes we might, but as soon as you shift that idea of instincts and you rather say, okay, this is how they're governing their societies, the discourse shifts and changes completely. You have to take it more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really think that this is a battle, you know, across all lines. The same was the case when it comes to children's rights and their call to be, you know, included in decision-making processes. And we've had huge positive leaps forward in that respect. And I just do hope, and, you know, if you look at the literature, it's so promising and rich. And I really hope, if you want to, I can share some of the links for your readers, for anyone who's interested in animal normativity and languages and how to include them in decision-making processes and all of that, if they're interested. So
that would be great. And perhaps you can tell us now also where, if someone is interested in the work you're doing, your book, as well as maybe wants to reach out to you about something you've mentioned, how can folks find out more about you?
Well, the easiest way would just be to enter my name to go into www.charlotteblattner.net. And you'll find all of my research. It's linked. You'll find my email address, etc. And maybe just for anyone interested in following up on some of the issues that we talked about today, namely animals in a global scheme, the book that I wrote is freely available, open access on Oxford University Press site. So you can.
It's incredible. I couldn't believe that I could just get the PDF.
yeah. It's a fascinating. So thanks to the Swiss National Science Foundation in that respect. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And I mean that cover picture is also what a great cover photo.
Oh gosh, yes. Shout out to Dana Allen if she ever hears that podcast. I'd love her. she's been absolutely incredible. I fell in love with this picture early on. It's called The Pecking Order. And I just felt like it has so much to tell when it comes to protecting animals and protecting animals globally. Yeah.
It's incredible. And the pecking order, what a good way to put what we've been speaking about here today. Well, Charlotte, I want to say thank you so much for your time. And I know it's getting quite late there for you now. So I hope you have a wonderful Easter weekend. And thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Gloria, for having me. I really enjoyed being here.
A big thank you to Gordon Clark for doing the bed music, Jeremy John for the logo, and a huge thank you to Animals in Philosophy, Politics, Law, and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hertzenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IRoarPod.com.